Welcome to the Tackle HIV Talk and Stigma podcast. I'm Gareth Thomas, and throughout this series, I'm talking to well-known guests about stigma and resilience. What it is, what it's like to experience it, how to overcome it, and what needs to be done to make stigma a thing of the past. Joining me today is a truly inspiring individual and someone who I'm very, very much looking forward to chatting to. It's athlete Lena Nielsen. Welcome, Lena. First of all, how are you doing?
Hi, Gareth. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing very, very well. Now, for those who might not be able to see, Lena is obviously in serious training at the moment because she looks absolutely fantastic. Now, Lena, you compete at the highest level for Great Britain in what is probably one of the most grueling events anyone could ever want to take part in, and that's the 400 metre hurdles. You were the European under 20 champion, a winner at the European Team Championships, and currently ranked in the world's top 20. Now that's pretty amazing as far as I'm concerned. But I feel what's even more amazing is that you are living with and competing with multiple sclerosis. Now most people wouldn't think that's possible, and they'd have a certain view on what someone's life with MS was like. Now, I'd like to chat to you about, I think, some of the similarities of you living happily and very successfully with MS and me living a happy and healthy life with HIV, and some of the public perceptions and barriers I think we're both working on to overcome. So first of all, I think, Lena, growing up as a child, did you always want to be an athlete? Was it always your driven ambition?
Do you know what? I don't think it was.
Oh. I
remember vividly either wanting to be a doctor or a funny one. I wanted to be an air hostess so I could travel the world.
Wow, two total ends of the spectrum there.
Those were the two things I wanted to do. And I really just wanted to travel the world. And I'm so like thankful that I can do that doing track and field. Yeah. But it was only like when I turned about 17 or 18, which actually coincided with my diagnosis, was when I decided that I wanted to do athletics, to just get as far as I could. And I never thought I'd, weirdly enough, but like everyone always goes, you know, I dream of being an Olympian, I dream of being this. And I wasn't actually like that. I just enjoyed training and I enjoyed running for as far as I could, as fast as I could. So yeah, it was just the fun of it. And then I just found myself doing it, you know, okay. And, you know, signing a contract. And then I was like, wow, this is something I could do. So I just kind of fell into it. And I like to use the term track and field found me instead of I found track and field.
So on that then, when you say track and field found you, I feel it's quite, it's coincidental that it was at that time that you feel track and field found you, that you also had your MS diagnosis. So having that diagnosis, first of all, how did that make you feel at that time with the knowledge, again, that track and field had found you at that time as well?
Yeah, you know, I was 17. So when I think I'm almost 27 now, that's 10 years ago. I just remember just feeling so young and I just wasn't ready to receive news like that. Mm. I really, really struggled and I didn't really know what it meant. You know, the early time I had heard of MS was in a biology class. And of course we heard about the most, you know, dire forms of it, where it was, you know, in 10 years after the diagnosis, you'll be in a wheelchair or, you know, you won't be able to live life. And we'd see these case studies of just the most, you know, sad cases. And I just thought that cannot be me, because I want to go to the national championships and run the 800 meters, which was my goal back then. I did pull out of those national championships when I was 17, so 18. It was the England under 20 championships. Right. And I ended up pulling out. But then I was, you know, it kind of almost gave me a purpose. I was very much like, hey, it's not my time now. You know, I was still dealing with, you know, the symptoms that led to that diagnosis. But I always remember thinking, I'm just going to keep pushing and see if I can get to the outdoor nationals.
Yeah.
I eventually did and so on. So it was I was very confused within myself as a human, as a person, but the athlete was always very much like, I'm just going to see how far I can get. And I never put a sort of goal, which I think was the key. I just wanted to see if I can enjoy it, if I could still run. And then I just ended up just, you know, hitting these check marks. So it was a bittersweet moment of my life.
Do you feel that there was a sense of, when you say you didn't know what it meant, was it a fear of the fact that if you don't know what it meant, then nobody else will know what it means? Therefore, Therefore, you kind of have to keep it a secret. But also, if you're going to, if you're going to keep it a success, a secret, you want to be a success as well. You know, you want to be able to not only prove yourself wrong if you don't know what it meant and you think the worst, but also if it comes to the point of having to tell everyone else, you can also prove everybody else wrong.
Yeah, and I think with MS and kind of what clouds the term MS is that not a lot of people know what it means. And so the one thing that a lot of people jump to, or the assumptions that people make, is coinciding with the word disability. And for a lot of people, the word disability is so scary. It's like, that's not me. I'm not disabled. I don't have a blue badge. And so you don't want to say you've got MS because you don't want people to automatically think that means you're disabled, because that's what a lot of people think. And so for me, when I got diagnosed, firstly, I didn't want to tell people because I couldn't tell people. I was still dealing with it myself. But then when I started to accept it and I started to understand that I'd just be living life with MS, I wanted, and at this point I was also getting better as an athlete, I wanted to, my goal was to make the Olympic Games. And then when I retire from track and field, I'd say, oh yeah, by the way, I also have had MS the whole time, because I just wanted, I wanted to show that it didn't have to mean disability for a lot of people who have MS. Obviously, it's so varied and so different for a lot of people. But that was my goal, was to do something first and then tell people that I had it, because I wanted to show that it was possible and to not have, you know, that label of the athlete with MS while I was competing. I wanted to just compete as an athlete and then tell people. But mainly it was because people just assume, I guess, unknowingly, they assume the worst when it comes to people living with MS.
Yeah, and also, I think kind of like in my cases, I think when people look at me, or when people looked at me previously before they knew about my HIV diagnosis, is I didn't want people to look at me. And for this one thing that almost, I want to kind of become a bit of an irrelevance in my life. All of a sudden, I felt if people know about it, then that's how they will define me. So, you know, it's kind of like if it sounds like what you're saying is if people look at you and straight away they know that you're living with MS, then that's going to be their definition of you when you're so much more.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I always feared, and so even now that I've told people, I've just feared I'm just going to be known as, that's the girl that has MS and she's running with MS. And it's like, I can get why that those two kind of go together. And it's an interesting story, I guess, because it's quite unique. But yeah, I'm hoping that I can do more with my track and field to kind of show, you know, that it's not, I'm not just the athlete with MS. But it, I think it's just natural to link a story to someone. You know, you'll always go, oh, that's the guy that has, for example, the Olympic champion in the high jump has half a beard.
Yeah,
he always competes with half a beard. And so you'll always go, that's the guy with half a beard. Like, it's always just the case. Someone, there's a story that gets linked to someone. And so it's not so much, I guess, a negative term to attach to someone. I guess it's just a way to distinguish them from someone else. I guess in a way, it's a positive. It makes you unique.
Yeah, but also I think it's a way of becoming a form of inspiration for others. Again, not necessarily with MS, but other forms of what people class as disabilities or ailments that they feel has this negative definition to them. I feel what you are doing is flipping it around. And I think by talking about it, you've become, you know, yes, you have a kind of a USP about it, but it's not a defining USP. It's a very inspiring USP. So did that motivate you? Because obviously when you found out or you had your diagnosis of MS, did you feel like then you had to find another way of continuing? Because did you have to maybe adapt your training? Because all of a sudden you realize now that you are still going to compete with MS, but things are going to be slightly different from now on.
Yeah, I mean, when I first got diagnosed, I was still... So the relapse, or the symptom that consequently led to the diagnosis, was paralysis down the right side of my body. So I was still dealing with the recovery from that. It took like a couple months to kind of recover from that. So it was really just like learning to walk again, learning to jog again, learning to run. So I had to adapt my training in that sense. And then once that went away, And this is the thing with relapsing remitting MS, which is the kind of MS that I have. And there's, I'd say there's two types mainly, and the other type is split into two. There's relapsing remitting MS and there's progressive MS. And so relapsing remitting, you get these symptoms, they'll appear or present themselves in your body for a couple of days, couple of weeks, couple of months, and then it can go down. The inflammation in your brain or your spinal cord will go down, and then you'll regain, you know, normal function of your body. So that's kind of MS I had. So when that symptom of the right side paralysis went away, I was literally just functioning as a normal, I could say normal, as a healthy human being. That's a bad word. So then I could just train normally, and I didn't have to adapt any training in any way. I just slotted right back into my training group, albeit I was, you know, at the back of the training group, but I still just slotted back in and just worked my way up again. So it was adapting mentally to kind of say, okay, I'm not as good as I used to be, but you know, we'll just start building again. So it was an adaptation in that sense. So really just a mental way to kind of, you know, reframe what training means for me and for someone who's, you know, dealing with any sort of illness. But in terms of, you know, seeing myself against other athletes, I just thought, you know, athletes have injuries and, you know, other illnesses, and, you know, they come back. So this is just my form of a setback. So I didn't have to adapt training physically in any way. Obviously, when I have relapses, I take a little step back, wait for my body to heal, and then continue training again. So it's a sort of a slower progression of training, I suppose.
What do you say about setbacks? Because I actually remember watching the interview you did after the race. Now, forgive me, if was the race in Oregon? Was it the championships in Oregon? When you made the announcement, and I think you decided to make it as an explanation maybe to what could have been deemed as a setback. Like, why did you feel like that was the right time for you to make that announcement? Was it because you felt like you had to explain why you were having the setback?
Yeah, so the kind of thought process that was going through my head, now that I look back here, I was in a very confused state of life, and I was like, what do I do? Like, what's the next step? Going into those world championships, I was climbing the ranks, like the rankings of the world. So I think I started the season being ranked, I want to say 42nd in the world. And then I was doing kind of like the Diamond League circuit. So that got me ranked even higher. And I was coming in the top five in those top races. So I was climbing the rankings. So by the time I got to the world championships, I went from like 42nd to 15th in the world. And so there was like a few previews of the world championships, and my name kept coming up, and it kept saying, you know, the Brit Lena Nilsson could probably make the final alongside the other Brit as well. So it was like, you know, she could make the final. And then kind of before the heats, there's that BBC preview where they kind of talk about, you know, which Brits are running in this event. And it was, you know, Lena Nilsson and Jessie Knight, who's the other top ranked Brit. And then I came last in my heat, which didn't make sense with those previews and the way I was competing in the season as well. The race didn't look okay. You know, I lost my stride pattern not even halfway in the race and just faded badly. And I just remember like knowing that it was a secret that I kept. And they asked me in the BBC interview, the interviewer kept asking, kept pushing, is it an injury? Is it an illness? Like, what happened? And I was just like, it's an illness. And then in my head, I was like, that's not a good enough answer, is it? And then so I flew home, and I was actually sat on this very sofa, and I was just contemplating my life. And I was like, what do I do? And something in my head just was, in my gut was telling me, look, maybe now's a good time to show, you know, the other side of being an athlete with MS. You know, it just didn't go well at those world championships, and maybe provide a little bit of explanation as to why I didn't, you know, hit those expectations from the outside and my own expectations. And it just, a lot of things were saying this is the right time. And yeah, and then we had the Commonwealth Games just very soon after the World Championships and the European Championships. And I just knew I wasn't going to be fully recovered for those. And I know from previous relapses and symptoms, it takes weeks to recover. And I just knew I wasn't going to be in fighting shape, but I was still selected to go to those championships. So it would kind of provide an explanation for those championships as well as to why I was going to be running slower. And it could kind of give a real-time view of someone competing with MS who is not completely healthy. And those were just, it was so many reasons, but those were the main reasons that were screaming out to me. And I was really glad when I did release my story, because I had so many people message to say that they were going to watch me people who have MS or people who have family members with MS, that they were going to watch me and they were going to support and just to see it. And I just think for me to be able to provide even just one person with that little bit of support just made all of it so worth it. And yeah, I was really proud of myself when I crossed the line at the final championship of the year. I did that.
So was the overwhelming response one of positivity then?
Yes, it was all so positive. And do you know what? I never expected so many people to reach out. And I really thought it was going to be two or three people that would be like, oh yeah, I watched your interview and I also have MS. But it was in like the high hundreds, like so many people. And it took me hours to respond to all those messages. And it was really positive. The main theme was inspiration, you know, motivation. And I actually had a lot of messages from other sports people who have MS who are also keeping it quiet. I'm talking.
Interesting.
Yeah. And that really surprised me. Like, so just off the top of my head, an Olympic gymnast, an Olympic skier, a CrossFit athlete, an ultra marathon runner. And more recently, I'm talking in the past couple of weeks, an elite hurdler.
So wow.
And that surprised me because, again, these are people who have decided to stay silent because, again, they are so scared of that perception that they'll get. But they were so happy that they could see someone else who was doing, competing in their sport with MS and that they'll be okay. And so even now, like, I'm still kind of, you know, receiving such positive messages, and I think it's just something that I'll carry for the remainder of my career.
So that's interesting how I feel, you know, when and I followed your story, how good the reception has been for you, yet still there's a perception which is holding people back from being, I suppose, their authentic selves because of a certain stigma around MS. So I suppose how do you attempt to kind of change that stigma around it if there's still people who don't want to speak about it for fear of being defined by, you know, something that isn't a disability to them?
Yeah, I mean, so I say that there were so many positive responses. There were some, I wouldn't say negative responses, but people who are slightly, I said, miseducated.
Yeah.
A few people messaged saying, so why didn't you compete in the Paralympics? And I was like, even if I went up to the Paralympic committee and I said, hey, I want to compete at the Paralympics, I would get laughed at in my face because I don't have a present disability. And so I understand why that is like a common perception, because again, that's all we see when it comes to MS. But I feel like people who are competing and the people that I said who are still competing in their sport, they have this fear that people will just, you know, label them as disabled. You know, why don't you go compete in the Paralympics? And I think for me, the one thing that I can do is just to be present and to show kind of real life. So, you know, I'm still posting my training videos, like training's going well. I haven't put, you know, so you'll find a lot of people with MS, they'll put, you know, some sort of hashtag in their Instagram bio or Twitter bio. And I feel like I don't want to do that because that's kind of putting like a label on me dealing with MS. So for me, it's just posting as if I'm just, you know, and I am just a healthy human being without putting that label on, you know, this is me doing, you know, a clean and jerk in the gym and I have MS. Like, no, it's just, this is me doing a clean and jerk. Just being present, just showing up, just being your authentic self. And I think that is one kind of one step or one of the first steps to really start to break that stigma, to not put a label on everything that, you know, that you do and to say that you're doing it despite having MS, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that does make sense. Because I think, you know, just I think something we should clarify for the people again who are listening is when you said about, you know, when people said, well, why didn't you become a para athlete? Like they would be para athletes with a more aggressive form of MS, I'm assuming, would there be?
Yes, actually, that's a really good point to make. So I said a little bit earlier that there are two types of MS, or three, sometimes people class three types. There's relapsing, remitting, there's primary progressive and secondary progressive, and they kind of just progress as life goes on. So it kind of will eventually present itself as a disability. Relapsing and remitting can present as a disability, and you can present as completely healthy. And it's so varied. And I sometimes argue it's an umbrella term because there are just so many ways that it can present itself. You could have a relapse and then have 50% recovery from that relapse. They still have a bit of residual nerve damage, or you can have 90% recovery, 95%, or maybe a full recovery from those relapses. And it's so different for some people. So there are a few athletes who compete in the Paralympics, para athletics with MS. And that's only because it's presented eventually as a disability.
Okay. And to those, I suppose to them, para athletes, I don't know, did you use the athletes who through no fault of their own, have probably had to be open about their MS because it's been a visual thing for them for many years. Did you use them as a form of inspiration then, or maybe even still now? You know, because Cadina Cox is one of the famous para athletes with MS. I actually did the jump with Cadina Cox.
That was scary.
Yeah, it was really scary. I ended up actually, my nickname for her in the end was Cadiva Cox because she was a real diva through the whole show. But a lovely person. And for me, it was interesting because I think I saw firsthand the effects of MS because we basically lived together in a hotel for... Oh, it seemed like about 2 or 3 months. And House, on a certain day, she'd be the life and soul of the party, and on another day, she'd struggle to get out of bed. So do you use people who are who have always been open about their MS? Do you use them as a form of kind of inspiration? Because I've always found, you know, with the Olympics, whenever you watch the Paralympics, I always find you get to know the person a lot more than the athlete, because para athletes seem to talk a lot more openly about their vulnerabilities. So obviously you started speaking about something which was perceived to be a vulnerability. So did you use Cadina or anybody else as a form of like help or inspiration or go-to?
Yeah, so Cadina's actually a really good friend of mine. She's amazing. She's just an incredible human being and an incredible athlete and just everything in between. She got diagnosed about 2 months after I got diagnosed. So she immediately told her story. And I remember seeing her around. Track and field is such a small world. And I remember seeing her around when she competed before the diagnosis. And then when she came out with her diagnosis, I immediately reached out to her because I hadn't really spoken to anyone about it. And I reached out to her and she responded like straight away with so much advice and so good positive words. And I just kept in touch with her all these years. And I actually told her before I told my story, I was like, it's time, Cadina, I'm going to tell people. And she was so supportive. And actually after the Commonwealth Games, so that was the first competition that I had after saying that I had MS, like she was right there at the finish line and just gave me the biggest hug that I just so needed. So I've used her as inspiration all these years. I'm talking 8 years now, I think. And also Ali Smith, she's another Paralympian who has MS. She's got secondary progressive. And I've watched her all this time. I didn't reach out to her before my diagnosis, but I'd always watch her races, you know, at the Paralympics or any para athletics that she was competing in, I'd be watching her. And then so when I released my story, she came up to me at the Commonwealth Games and I was like, oh, it's so good to finally meet you. I've literally watched every single one of your races. I felt like a fan. She was like, have you? I was like, yeah, I've watched every single one of your races. So they've been sort of inspiration to me. And, you know, they're just so powerful as I'd say human beings first and then athletes, you know. Yeah. And I think it's really important to kind of see those people again being so vulnerable and just being so open, and you get to see them compete and just to kind of be amongst them in terms of inspiration is already a privilege enough. So yeah, I think it's just so important because they've helped me, I guess, without even realizing. So I don't even know, you just don't know how many people you're reaching who might be looking up to me and still to them. So
when you talk about vulnerability as you did then, again, I think for me when, you know, I was forced to talk about my HIV diagnosis, which made me very vulnerable. What I found, as well as it being a personal feeling, vulnerability, it was also something that I'd say affected my family and my really close friends. So I think we've heard a lot of how personally you felt. How did you feel that you opening yourself up in such a vulnerable way? How do you feel that that affected your family or your really close friends? Because, you know, family and really close friends are very protective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's really interesting in my case, because my twin sister is also a professional athlete, and she got diagnosed in 2021 with MS. And so when I released my story, I had to warn her, I'd be like, look, people are going to start asking you questions about your MS as well, because she got diagnosed and she was still kind of dealing with that diagnosis. So I kind of had to let her know that, you know, this might affect you as well now, you know, I'm going to be vulnerable. So I kind of felt a bit, a bit guilty, you know, just pushing her story out there as well. But, you know, it's been really okay for her. And in terms of like all my friends, so I made sure to message all my friends before. I knew the article was going to come out a bit before the Commonwealth Games. And so I messaged all my friends. I said, hey, like, this is what's happening. And they were just also supportive. You know, my close circle, they never treated me differently when I got diagnosed and didn't treat me differently after, you know, being public with MS. And then the most vulnerable state that I was like competing at those Commonwealth Games. Like my race just went so horrible and I was just not okay. I was super fatigued and I don't even watch that race back. It was just awful. And like they was just, you know, saying this doesn't define you as an athlete. Like all your performances haven't been taken away just because you had that one bad race. So it was really important for me to have my close friends and family just, you know, to remind me that, you know, those bad performances and, you know, bad health with MS is not who I am. And so it really kept my strength up. And I think that was really important to have those kind of people.
How did you find you were treated by, when you started competing again, how did you find you were treated by your teammates? But maybe, I don't know, by the opposition. Because I suppose in a way, you know, I spoke about my HIV diagnosis after I'd retired playing rugby. And I think within any sport, you know, that I think the psychological warfare that can go on, you know, pre-race or pre-game can be a big part of winning or losing. And I know when I spoke about my sexuality when I played rugby, I was really, I felt really honoured that nobody used my sexuality in a way to kind of get under my skin or to wind me up or to push it so I'd give penalties away or to push it that I'd get sent off. Like, did you ever feel that from, you know, have you ever felt, you know, that from teammates or competitors that you've been treated differently in a negative way? Or has everything been the same? Because I think sometimes, you know, people think, you know, that you've done it to be celebrated. And you haven't done it to be celebrated. You've done it not to be discriminated against. You've done it actually to be treated equal.
Yeah, no, you know, I don't think there was any negative experiences towards me. It was more pity, if that's the right word to use. It was, you know, being treated like I was a fragile character that just needed to be, you know, checked on. And in terms of when I then end up going to the European Championships, there was so many championships last year. It's hard to keep that. When I end up going to the European Championships, that was a big team of British athletes. I think there's 120 of us, which is just a big team. It was massive. And I just remember walking into the dining hall and everyone was staring at me and I was like, this is, well, not everyone, but like, a lot of people were like looking at me, like, is she walking funny? Like, is she okay? Like, what's she doing here? Shouldn't she be resting? And then the physios were like really checking up on me, like, we've got a free slot this afternoon. Do you want to come and, you know, get checked? I'm fine, guys. I'm honestly fine. It was just, and I remember when I went to a specific journalist to release the story. And the first thing I said to him was, first and foremost, this is not a sob story in any way, shape or form. Don't put any kind of, you know, pity connotations to this story. It was one of the things I wanted to avoid, but I think it just comes with having, I guess, an illness that can present in a way that's quite, severe, I guess, in use of that word. So it wasn't so much negative, and you know, track and field is, I'd say, very supportive environment.
Okay. Well, even when you're, you know, the heat of competition, you know, because I know some people I've spoken to, you know, in the changing rooms before they go out, it's kind of like, you know, it becomes kind of like a psychological kind of stare down, or really fueled.
I think mainly in the shorter sprints. I can't speak for them, but from the stories I've heard, the shorter sprints, and specifically the male shorter sprints.
That's who I've spoken to, people who compete in them. Yeah,
they can be, you know, there's that talk of getting into people's heads and stuff. When it comes to the 400 hurdles, and I switched from the 400 to the 400 hurdles, the switch in camaraderie between the 400 girls and the 400 hurdle girls, it was so different. Like, we're so supportive of each other, you know. There's not really a rivalry in the UK. Like, all the top-ranked 400 hurdlers are so friendly to each other. Like, we're in the call room giving each other lip gloss and, you know. Like, it's just really supportive. And I was really surprised, because the 400, I guess it's more of a sprint than the 4 hurdles. Mm. I think the more sprinty the event is, the more that tensions rise. With the 400, it was definitely, you know, a bit of tension in the call room, you know, right before the race. But in the 4 hurdles, it's just so lovely. It's like rainbows and butterflies compared to the room that was the shorter sprint.
That sounds like the changing rooms I want to be in.
Yeah, I mean, and then when I finished the Commonwealth Games, my heat, you go back into the call room to get your kit. And I had both the two Jamaicans who are in my heat just like run up to me, like, I read your article, I read your story, like, it's amazing. The fact that you got into the start line, like, it was very, very positive. You know, there wasn't anything, oh, well, she's out of the competition now. It was very much like, we hope you do well and we'll see you next year kind of thing. It was really lovely.
So I suppose moving forward now, are you, I don't know, I suppose, like, are you inspired, right, by the fact that you've been very authentic and you represent something now, whether you want to admit it or not? I feel you represent the very human side of athletics that I suppose not so many people see. So is your motivation to be successful because of what you represent on a side of people understanding what MS is? Or is your motivation what it always was, and that's to be successful because you want to be successful as an athlete?
It's a really good question, actually. I'm going to have to think about that. You know what? I think it's a bit of both in varying ways. When I'm going to go back to last year, because it was, you know, a lot changed last year. When I came back from the World Championships, there was a voice in my head saying, end your season, just rest. But then when I released my story, that gave me so much motivation to just go again, go to the Europeans. And I was, by the time the Europeans came around, that was about a month after the World Championships, and I had lost so much training. I was skinnier as well. My muscle had just depleted. And like, nothing was pushing me to compete. I didn't have anything to prove. You know, I had already got my world ranking, already was basically finalized. There was no other reason for me to compete. And the one thing that pushed me to go was to provide, I guess, inspiration for people with MS. And that was really the driving force to take me to the Europeans. Now that I'm back into training and back into almost full health, the motivation is what it's always been, and that's just to get as far as I can to make the World Championship team, to make the Olympic team, hopefully. That's the primary focus. But there is a little part of me that is being extra push because of hopefully that the icon that I can be to people who are dealing with any sort of illness.
I think, do you know, the reason why I ask that question is because I think when it comes to like tackling stigma or dealing with stigma, is first of all, we self-stigmatize ourselves, which is something I've done and something you've spoken about, in that, you know, we kind of don't really understand ourselves. And then when I understood what HIV was, or when you understood what MS was, you feel that then you have a role to play in educating everybody else. And I feel that when you grow as a person, then you kind of grow into that role, and it becomes something that's, you know, becomes something that's really, really important to you, and it becomes something that you want to be part of your success. It's not all about that. But part of your success is learning to be a successful athlete. Because I remember people used to say to me when I spoke about my sexuality, first of all, and I said to people, you know, I don't want to be known as the gay rugby player. And then 5 or 6 years later, I remember thinking to myself, well, I'm gay and I'm a rugby player. So why don't I want to be known as the gay rugby player? You know, I've accepted it. I've dealt with it. And now I want to help other people be able to accept and deal with it. If they're in the same kind of situation. So on that, so what do you feel then are the barriers to changing the perceptions that people have of people living with MS? You're obviously one, and I think you continuing to be you is very much doing that. But what do you feel the other barriers are?
Oh, that's a good question. You hit the nail on the head there with that point you said about, you know, being a rugby player and being gay and, you know, being an athlete and having MS. You know, I do feel like the past few months I've really come into a form of acceptance.
Yeah.
I felt like I was fighting this, like trying to prove to people that I'm not disabled, that I'm not going to go to the Paralympics. And now it's like, you know, okay, if you want to feel that way, that's fine. But let me just tell you a little bit more about MS so that you can really understand.
I genuinely think, you know, I generally feel that the minute you're able to embrace it, you know, the minute other people start to accept you more, because it's kind of, I don't want to hide it. You know, I don't want to deny it. In fact, I want to start talking about it. In fact, I want to educate you about it. And I think being that proactive person on a subject that society is misled about is the only way the society will kind of, you know, understand the barriers that are there and what you're trying to do to break them barriers down. So when I say, you know, what kind of other barriers are out there, is it just because you think that as soon as people think of somebody living with MS, they expect to see somebody in a wheelchair, somebody who, you know, needs help to go from A to B? Is that the perception that you think that is out there?
Yeah, and you know, when you speak about barriers, I think the main barrier will come from yourself or from myself, from anyone's self, is that, you know, you think people have this perception, so you kind of hold yourself back or you know, dim your light down a little bit so as to not feed into that perception. But really, like, perceptions, like, how are they affecting you really? Like, you know, you can just go out there and just do the performance that you know best, you know. And I think if, you know yourself and you're very secure in yourself, your sport or whatever venture that you're doing, if you're very secure and confident in that, then, you know, those perceptions shouldn't really matter to you in that kind of space, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
And so I feel like, at first it was very much like, okay, I need to prove to people that, you know, I'm okay. You know, I wasn't okay, but I wanted to prove to people that I was okay and I'm healthy. And it was kind of fighting that perception, like trying to fight, you know, that say that you are, you know, now disabled, that you're this, that, and the other. But actually I should have just focused on the performances and what I can do that day, and whoever wants to perceive it a certain way perceives it. But then after that, there becomes that role that you said, you know, that responsibility, this platform that you now have to really start to educate people. Not so much to remove the barriers, but to kind of, you know, I guess to remove the barriers, but to kind of educate more so that people can really understand a bit more, as to remove those, you know, classic perceptions that people.
So do you honest, and I think this is a very much an honesty question, is like, do you honestly care now about what people perceive of you, of people who don't know you? And by the way, before you answer that question, I feel like it is okay to say yes. It is okay to say, yeah, I do care.
Oh, do I care how people perceive me?
Yeah, when you say at the start of the interview, you know, the perceptions of people living with MS are not true to the reality of some of the different forms of MS. Do you care then how you're perceived? You know, when people say, "Oh, you know, well, why don't you? Why aren't you in the para athletes?" You know, or You know, do you care that much about that perception of other people?
I think part of me does. Does care a little bit. You know, I had one hateful message last year, and I carried that with me for so many weeks. Like, compared to all the positive messages I got, it was that one negative message that really stuck with me. And I don't know why. And I questioned it for a long time. You know, I love to journal, and I'd always put in my journals, like, why do I still think about that one message? Mm. And I think the reason why I thought about it so much was because it was wrong. It was wrong what they said. I guess the message alluded to the fact that I was doing this for publicity, that I was doing it to, you know, get a celebrity status. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, but I think the reason I cared about it so much was because it wasn't right. Yeah. What they said was completely a wrong perception. And I think part of me still cares about how people perceive me, because it's another wrong perception. It's not completely right. So part of me, I guess, cares because I want to right the wrongs, because I want you to see me in a truthful way. So yeah. I guess that part of, that's why I care so much. And I think that's why I want to show up, and I want to, you know, speak out, and I wanted to show kind of what it actually is for some people with MS who have a similar type of MS to me. And I'm not, you know, and I try to be really sensitive and careful to the other side of MS, which can present, you know, in a disability and, you know, an unhealthy kind of way. But then I also didn't want to neglect the other people who have MS, who are 90% of the time living a healthy lifestyle. So yeah, it's one of my motivations to speak out a bit more is just to be truthful to that side of MS, yeah. You know, to show that it's not, you know, all, I say doom and gloom. It's not really doom and gloom, but, you know, to show that it's not always sad.
Do you feel that other people you've spoken to, or have you heard of other people who are living with MS as well? People like Kadena, for instance, like, do they face forms of stigma as well? Do they face forms of discrimination on a kind of regular, or it doesn't matter if it's regular or irregular, to be honest with you, but on a basis, do they face it?
Yeah, I know Kadena deals with a lot of it, and, you know, I can't really speak so much for her because, you know, her experience is her experience. But from what I could tell, after she went on I'm a Celebrity, she got a lot of hate, especially on TikTok. I think social media is just, you know, one of those things where you see one side of your life, you know, we call it a highlight reel. Yeah. She had a lot of hate on TikTok because when the cameras were on I'm a Celeb, I'm sure it was probably similar when you did the jump, she wasn't in a wheelchair. And so people were like, you're lying, you never need to use a wheelchair and stuff like that. And then she had to almost prove that she needed a wheelchair. And I was like, it's so sad because you don't have to prove this, you know, like, and it's sad because there was a lot of hateful comments, and she almost had to like prove that she wasn't lying, and that it's MS presents itself. Some days you're fine and some days you're not, in her case, for example. So I felt really sorry for her, and I'd always see her, you know, posting TikToks where she would put herself in her wheelchair and film it. And I was like, that's so sad because people have forced you to do that, and not forced you, but the hate that you got has led you to think that that's what, you know, you need to prove. So I guess in her case, there was another perception there that was, again, wrong. And she had to prove her truth and her right.
Yeah.
And it's, do you know what it is? MS is just so, number one, it's very, very person to person. So if you say I have MS and you see people in a wheelchair, people just automatically assume, well, if she's in a wheelchair, shouldn't you be in a wheelchair? But then with that comes the misunderstanding of what MS actually is, and kind of the different forms of MS that you see. So for example, people always think that, you know, we should all be in a wheelchair because that's the only form of MS that we really see. And so if we start to see other forms of MS, we can start to say, oh, okay, so she says she's got MS, but I know someone else who has MS who competes on track and field, so she must have her type of MS. And so that's where it's really important, I think, for people to show different types. And then that way, I think we can start to remove certain perceptions of MS.
Yeah, because science and medicine has made big steps in MS and in HIV. For instance, in HIV, when you're on effective medication, you cannot transmit the virus through sexual contact. But most people still who live with HIV experience stigma in one form or another, whether it's being excluded or shunned by family and friends, to being discriminated against at work or elsewhere, or being verbally abused. And that's why, You know, I started the Tackle HIV campaign together with Vive Healthcare and the Terence Higgins Trust as the charity partner, and with the great support of Prince Harry and Sir Elton John. Yeah, and I think, again, I think from what you're doing and just your authentic self, because we do a survey with Tackle HIV around the subject of HIV, obviously, and it says that on one of our surveys we did, 68% said their views about HIV have changed over their lifetime. And that's because of organisations like charities like Terence Higgins Trust, the Tackle HIV campaign that I run. And 50% are saying they are now better informed. However, levels of misunderstanding don't reflect this. Because, for example, fewer than one in five, which is 18% of people, know that someone living with HIV who is on effective treatment cannot pass HIV on to their sexual partner. When told this is the case, of the 82% of those who didn't know this fact, 22% said they didn't believe it. 19% said that they wish they'd known before as it had changed their view. A third said it made them less fearful of people living with HIV. So, again, what I think this shows in what we are doing here at Tackle HIV and what you're doing and what the stories you're telling us about yourself and in particular then about Kadena is that education is key. Like educating people who have a very stereotypical perception of something that isn't as obvious as they first thought creates a better environment. A better environment for everybody. And that's why I feel it's really important that you firstly spoke about it, but also I think it's really important that you continue to speak about it. You don't let it define you, but as we said earlier, I think you've accepted it, and by accepting it and continually speaking about it and being your successful self, you're actually going to change people's perceptions of what MS is, how there are different forms of MS, and how you can be still successful with any form of MS. Do you agree with that?
100%. I think you've just hit the nail on the head there. And, you know, I take it back to like a rogue example. We all once thought the Earth was flat, you know? I think the human race once thought...
Are you telling me it's not?
and then we all just started to get, you know, these little nuggets of information, and then we all realize actually the Earth's not flat. And it's kind of like that, you know, we all have this one belief that something's a certain way, and then you get these nuggets of information or these little pieces of someone's life, and then you can start to see the whole picture. And I think that's what obviously you're starting to do with Type of HIV, and hopefully I can provide just a little bit of a glimpse into the other side of MS. And I think that's why I'm really passionate about kind of talking about it. I'm working on a documentary with Sky at the moment to kind of show different sides of MS and talking to like so many different people. I spoke to a neuroscientist recently that really just opened my eyes, and now I'm someone living with MS, and the things that he said was just so powerful, and I'm so excited to release that project. But I just think, yeah, if we can have just so many more people just providing little glimpses of personal life, but then also education, science, information as well.
Yeah.
Painting the whole picture.
So when it comes to yourself then, apart from this amazing documentary coming up on Sky that you just dropped in there, you've got some big, big championships coming up. How are preparations going? How are preparations going for it?
Yeah, do you know, they're going really well at the moment, actually. I was still kind of struggling with training a little bit. So our training year kind of runs from about October until the championships in August. So the first few months I was like, oh, could this be my retirement? But no, the training's going really well. I've been learning so many new things about my event, which I'm really excited to put into play. My outdoor competition season starts in 2 months. So nervous. But I'm also really excited to get it underway because I feel like I've changed certain things about my race. So just to put them into play will be really exciting. We've got the World Championships in August this year. Hopefully if I keep my ranking at the moment, which is in the top 20, to get in. And then the Paris Olympics the following summer,
which is come on.
Exciting. Nerve-wracking, but super exciting. yeah, just lots to look forward to.
Before I kind of shut it down, this is one thing I've always, I don't know, I feel like I've always wanted to be. So I got this opportunity to ask you this question. Are you in the top 20 in the world right now?
Yeah, 16th.
Right.
I got so down.
You sound like that's a bad thing, because this is what I could net. So I'm I played rugby, which is very much always part of a team. Like, how does it feel? Like, you say like you're devastated, but to be 16 because you got pushed down. But like, how does it feel to be the 16th best 400 meter hurdler female in the world? Like, that's the top 20, like in the world, out of everyone who runs that event in the world. Like, how does that feel?
Do you know, sometimes I do pinch myself. Like, a 17-year-old me would be so pleased. She'd be like, what? Like, how do we get to top 20? But then other parts of me, I think it's the athlete in you. You're just never satisfied. You're just kind of like, oh, but now, okay, I want to be top 15 and then top 10 and then, wow. You know. So part of me is not satisfied. I want to be inching closer to the top 10 rankings, which would be great. But yeah, I think sometimes you have to just, you know, take a moment to really just be proud of yourself. And I definitely am.
Oh, you've got to be proud of yourself. So I think kind of to round it off, for people who are listening to this podcast, what can they do to get to have better knowledge, to be better educated around MS? What do you feel is like kind of, you know, things that they should do for their everyday life?
So the number one top tip I would give, controversially, is don't Google what is MS. There are not good sources that will come up. The one thing I'd say is go to known organizations. The MS Trust has amazing resources. The MS Society has amazing resources. And then even kind of for younger people, shift.ms has a great forum for people who are kind of late teens, early 20s. That's another great resource. And just if you really want to learn about it, there are great resources on that. And then I think the other great advice is I would, if you can, find people who have MS, you know, either public figures or people that you know, and ask them what their experience of MS is, or like look at Kadena's Instagram or TikTok or my Instagram or TikTok or social media, and other, you know, public figures. I know there's a few Hollywood actors or actors released their stories recently. I think Christina Applegate is a recent one. You know, maybe learn about her life and her personal experience, because that's the best way to kind of get a full understanding of MS.
Yeah, because for me, you know, education is the key. And we have a website here at Tackle HIV, which is tacklehiv.org. Or you can go to the Terence Higgins Trust website or follow us on social media at TackleHIV, where you can educate yourself and others about HIV so that you treat people living with HIV the same way that you would treat others. So, Lena, I just want to say now, thank you. That's been brilliantly interesting, amazingly insightful. It sounds like what you're saying is that together we can all make a difference. So join us for our future podcast, where I'll be talking to more guests about stigma. Lena, you are a legend.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Bless you. Thank you so much.